Hello, what have we here?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Resistance Radio. It's episode 62. Hope you all enjoyed last week's show, because this week it's all about Hera Syndulla. As always, I'm Mikey B, joined by my co-host, Danya.
Hi everyone.
If you want to get involved in our conversation, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at @rradiopodcast. Leave a comment on our Facebook page. Send us an email through our website, resistanceradio.net, or leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hypeable.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, get the latest Star Wars audiobook for free. We've also launched our Patreon. Check that out at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. There are some awesome perks up there, like Discord chat, where you can join us in our recording studio, our movie nights, After Dark episode, which we just found some interesting news to discuss during our After Dark episode. Danya, anything else you want to add about Patreon? I heard you laughing.
No, I was laughing about the After Dark content that we have for the After Dark episode. It's interesting is a word for it.
There you go. That's one way to describe some of it. If you can't afford us on Patreon, we appreciate any support. We do have t-shirts and buttons available for sale on our website at resistanceradio.net. So I think it's time for the news. So this week, you know, obviously we had last week's episode right before the 40th anniversary. All sorts of great stuff happened during the 40th, but no news. It was all more a celebration, which is, I think, was great. You know, I watched Star Wars. I don't know. Did you do anything on the 40th? Danya?
No, we talked about this. Didn't we record the last episode on the 40th?
We did it the day before, and I said, did you have any plans? So, and I said I was going to watch the movie. That's kind of all I did. And I went to the Disney store, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, there's no Disney store near enough to me to be able to go and do that. So,
well, I don't know if you're like, oh yeah, I decided to watch A New Hope, or, you know, read the comic. I don't know.
I was looking after my baby cousin, so.
There you go. Did you introduce him to Star Wars?
No, he has just turned 2 years old.
That's
too young for him.
2 years ago.
No, too young for him to actually be able to have any kind of retention and memory sort of doing it. So, like, when he's a little bit older, like, I'm guessing probably around 3 or 4, then yes, absolutely. And his dad will also be of the opinion that he should be watching Star Wars. So yes, we will probably have a Star Wars movie night, but when he's a little bit older.
Okay, we'll do that. So our first bit of news is pretty interesting. Rian Johnson took to Twitter recently to kind of combat some tweets about people complaining about Star Wars recycling stories and imagery. You know, we saw this with The Force Awakens. People were kind of like, oh, it was too much like A New Hope. Or people were like, oh, no, it was a combination of the entire, you know, original trilogy. But Rian Johnson was responding to, essentially, I would say, internet trolls about how, you know, The Last Jedi is just going to be like Empire Strikes Back. You know, obviously, we've heard it's darker. What do you think about this, Danya?
I mean, I think I've spoken quite extensively on how I feel about, like, the idea of people taking, like, not offense, but basically going, like, a little bit nuts over the fact that there are similar story beats. And that the problem with it is that, I mean, one, we see it in real life, and I've said it before, history repeats itself over and over and over again. We basically hurtle ourselves towards catastrophic moments in our own history. Wars, conflicts, everything like that. So the fact that things follow a pattern and things come around again and you see the same sort of story happening, it isn't completely unheard of in real life either. So from that kind of perspective as well, like, it's not an unusual or unheard of thing. The other thing that we need to remember as well, and keep in mind still, which people seem to forget all the time, is that The Force Awakens had to remind fans of the familiar. mostly because, regardless of how you personally feel about the prequels, on the whole, they're fairly universally disliked when it comes to critical reception. Though it does have redeeming qualities, on the whole, people don't generally like them, and they're fairly ridiculed. So, what The Force Awakens had to do is it had to remind fans why they loved Star Wars. And the easiest way to do that is through familiarity and story beats that feel as though they're an homage, or they re-invoke that feeling that you had when you first watched Star Wars. And the thing is that they did it in a way that framed and set up this new story and moved on from there. And now what they can do, now that that groundwork has been sort of put in place, is completely move away from it. None of the other Star Wars films now have to do that. They don't need to remind you of why you loved Star Wars. They don't need to breathe this familiarity. They can do whatever they want because they're moving past the fact that it needed to, like, reintroduce this universe to a whole new audience, and then also remind people of where Star Wars came from. So, honestly, Rian Johnson's comments it's perfect, because it's exactly what everyone has said, is that what The Force Awakens in its familiar story beats has allowed all following Star Wars movies to do is not need to be derivative or remind you of any of the previous Star Wars films. It now has the freedom to be able to move outside of that box. So that's what I think about it.
I agree. I think he responded not rudely. He responded very matter-of-factly. I'm going to go ahead and read of the tweet thread between the two of them a little bit, just so that our listeners know exactly what we're talking about. So, a user on Twitter, and this is the only tweets he has, is to Rian Johnson about The Last Jedi, says, "Like so many fans, I'm worried about it. Yes, if you look at YouTube, Reddit, Jedi Council Forum, Star Wars News, IMDb, it went down in other sites, disclosure, like basically what happens. Among Star Wars fans, there are many, many others who feel the same way, and by the biggest concern is by too much recycling of plot points and imagery at that extent. It's not a few contrarians, it's legitimate widespread critique. Any chance you can address these concerns in a meaningful way without dismissing the issue?" So that's across like 6 or 7 tweets where basically, you know, he's asking him a legitimate question, and I get it. And Rian Johnson responds is, "I've addressed it the only way I possibly can by spending the past 3 years of my life making a film I do not think is derivative. I can't do much for you beyond that. If you decide to not see it, it'll be a disappointment, but I'll understand." Another person chimes in and says, "Well, creativity is important." And then they respond with, "Integrating familiarity and creativity for fans is a challenge." And then Rian Johnson simply says, "It's a tricky balance." So, like, he didn't respond negatively at all, but just simply like, "Hey, I've poured my life into this for 3 years. I think it's a great film. I think it looks amazing myself. And I know there's going to be familiar beats. If there weren't familiar beats, I probably wouldn't be happy with it. Because it's Star Wars, you know what I mean? Like, you want the classic stuff." And I do think, you know, Force Awakens, for all its pitfalls that Force Awakens may have had, I liked it because I feel like it's one of those things where even friends of mine who had not seen the original trilogy and the prequels, they could jump into Force Awakens and be okay with it. Because they introduce the history of Star Wars through Han Solo, and it's like, oh no, it's true, all of it, like everything that's there. So like, even if you don't know all about it, you can go back and learn it, and it won't take away from what you've seen in Force Awakens. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. The other thing as well with The Force Awakens that people will always seem to forget is that for a lot of people, that is their first Star Wars film. You're never going to get away from that. That is their first experience of Star Wars. And it basically is a really good, like, introduction for people, because it does enough to, like, hark back to the originals while also introducing something new, and also gives enough information of the original trilogy as well. Like, it had such a difficult job, and it was never going to please 100% of people 100% of the time. It doesn't matter what it did. It wasn't going to be perfect for everyone. But for me, what I love about it, and what I will continue to love about it and defend it over, is the fact that it has basically introduced Star Wars to a whole new generation of people who love it and love the characters that have come from it and have now gone back to experience the rest of it. And it's not a perfect film. No film, I feel, is completely perfect anyway. But do I love it? Yeah. Do I rewatch it quite a lot? Yeah, absolutely. It's enjoyable. And in fact, even though it has familiar story beats, and even though for some people it's derivative or it feels too close to A New Hope, for me, it's not exactly A New Hope. The characters are different, their motivations are different, the way they interact is different. Like, there is enough in it that differentiates it from A New Hope that if that's the only thing that you could lay at its feet, then I think it's done pretty well.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. If that's the only thing they can say is, like, it's done a good job because it is Star Wars. Moving on, though, because we did mention that we are following up on Star Wars 40th, StarWars.com has a whole section dedicated to all the things that have popped up, celebrations, and just general tidbits about the film over the 40 years, including an amazing article about the original poster and seven things we didn't know about it. And I will say, going through this, I would say probably about six of the things I didn't know. So I thought this was a great article myself. And when I'm talking about the original poster, it's the A-frame poster. So with Luke with his hands up in the air with a lightsaber, kind of doing the Kylo Ren style thing sticking out of the side. Leia, all super muscular, hanging out, leg kicked out, the blaster. Vader's face in the background, and way too many X-Wing starfighters attacking a disco ball Death Star. We all know that poster. It's the kind of classic Star Wars, you know, New Hope one. But Donnie, what you think of this article? We'll just kind of go through the seven things real quick in it, but what you think of it in general?
I actually thought it was really interesting because I love sort of hearing different, like, I like knowing about the thought processes or the sort of creative process behind posters and behind artwork. So yeah, for me, it was really, really interesting just to get a little bit more insight behind the poster and sort of how it came to be and why certain things were chosen to be included. And yeah, there were a couple of things here that I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And so I love it when that happens as well.
Mm-hmm. So just a real quick kind of go through the list of the seven so you guys can know what we were talking about here. First of all, this poster was originally painted by Tom Young in 1977, and it holds a lot of different secrets and little known facts about it. The very first bit is, if you look at it, Luke, when he's on that, actually I have that poster right here to the right of me next to my Family Guy version of it. That poster, I just looked up and I was like, oh, it's right there. Luke is actually wearing Darth Vader's boots in white, minus the knee guards, which I thought, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, he never wears anything near that in A New Hope, but that's what he's wearing on the poster. They're very clearly designed after Vader's boots. The droids R2-D2 and C-3PO were added after the original artwork was completed, not by Young, but by Nick Carty, who is famous for his 1960s comic book covers for Aquaman and Teen Titans. So, you know, obviously you have to remember, back in the 70s, there's not the internet, so these are reprinted in newspapers and different things. So the original art has got modified at some point along the line with the multiple reissuing of the Star Wars film in theaters and stuff like that between 77 and 78, or even as the film was released. Princess Leia's blaster is actually Han Solo's blaster, the artwork. Wardrobe changes. Princess Leia had a significant amount of wardrobe changes from the original sketch. It was going to be much more risque, if you will, with more see-through type clothing. I guess in the 70s, that's kind of what you would expect, maybe. I don't know, Donnie, what do you think about that?
I'm glad that they chose not to go with that, mostly because even though we get Slave Leia further down the line, for the most part, Leia's wardrobe is very modest. So I feel as though the version of the dress that we get on that poster is close enough to the ones that she wears in the actual film, but not nearly as risque as the one. Like, okay, I'll say the original sketch, those boobs are not real as well.
Yeah. Well, and also, if you look at the legs, because you see both her legs, it almost looks like she's like, I kind of wanted to say like a faun or some type of mythical creature.
Oh, yeah.
The legs are like positioned in like some weird, awkward, like, I don't know.
It's basically, there's a series of drawings that were done, oh gosh, around the time, not long after the Avengers came out, the Avengers movies came out, because people were picking up on the fact that comic book covers that featured women on them were either posed in like completely impossible poses, or like their organs were like being crushed because the proportions of them were like completely awful, but that sort of thing. So what people did is they started something called the Hawkeye Initiative, where they redrew these impossible covers that were basically incredibly sexist and put Hawkeye on them instead. So it just, like, looking at the original sketch of this, it just reminds me so much of those impossible poses that they put women into on comic book covers with the, like, over-the-top proportions and all of that. So, yeah, I'm glad that they, you know, moved in a direction that was more Leia.
Yeah. Well, beyond that, just her outfit is she's also wearing an outfit similar to what she wears at the very end of the film.
Yeah.
Never holding a blaster when she's giving away the medals to Han and Luke, never to Chewie. But yeah, so it's interesting that they chose that outfit. And then as you go forward, it's also a newspaper cover up. Actually, this original artwork was originally done for a half sheet. Where the characters were on the left-hand side, there's a little bit of more scene, you know, iconography from the film. Like you see the full sheet with Darth Vader again in the background, Luke and Leia with the lightsaber up. But then you see an explosion that I'm assuming is the Death Star, some X-Wings. And then you see the Chewie, Han, and Luke at the award ceremony. So I'm assuming Young probably got to see an early cut or just scenes of the film. And that's why he modeled certain things after this. But apparently the A-style poster may never actually have been there for opening day also. The earliest release, or the earliest date of it in the Lucasfilm archives is from July 27th, 2 months after the original release in May 25th. So I find it interesting that the original poster may not have actually been there. They may not have had an actual poster or something else they would have had for the actual release. So what do you think about just that at the end, Danya?
I love that. I mean, it's just really funny that, like,
it's like,
don't actually have the poster for the film.
Well, you also got to remember that at the same time, like, in the 70s, you know, films were done differently, distributed very differently. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that they would have had different branding and different things. And,
yeah.
You know, theaters on their own would have had a little bit more free range to, like, advertise for different stuff. I know, like, some of my theaters even do special things for different films. Especially if they're not big films, but they're cult following films, they'll do like own decorations and stuff. So it's not official branding from the film and stuff. And they don't have to worry about being sued like they would today, because there's no Snapchat or Instagram or Twitter about, hey, this theater in XYZ place posted this and that's against the branding regulation. You know, who knows what they do now. So it's kind of a fun story. So definitely check out StarWars.com and see all the amazing little tidbits of stuff that's come out over the last 40 years for A New Hope. Next bit of news is a piece of news that I'm very excited for, is Star Wars and the Power of Costume has opened at the Cincinnati Museum. This opened also on the 40th anniversary, the 25th. The Cincinnati Museum is holding a Power of Costume till October 1st, and you'll actually be able to see exhibits of actual costumes used in the film. Everything from armor from Boba Fett, Jango Fett, Zam Wessel, to elaborate gowns from Queen Amidala, Queen Jamila, and the Handmaidens. Obviously, military stuff from Stormtroopers and TIE Fighters. So it's going to be pretty cool to see all this stuff. I have a friend who's going up this weekend, and he's going to give me a full report on it, and I will probably be going up in the next couple weeks. One cool thing that I found out from this as I was going through it is they've actually released coloring pages that I'm going to link to on our website, where you can actually just take the time to color. My favorite is, you know, having the museum in the background and Luke at the homestead with the twin sons in the background. So I'm going to do some coloring on my own to relax this week. What about you, Danya?
These are really nice, but also, like, Luke has no face.
I know. It's I will say, I almost feel like to make the... I'll be honest with you. For when it comes to the coloring side, it looks like someone took something... took it into Photoshop, composited like the logo of like the museum in the background, and then use Live Trace from Illustrator. Yeah. Now this is like getting super geeky, but you see it on the Millennium Falcon.
Oh yeah, like, No, I'm looking at it and I'm like, this is a really sweet idea, but also I'm kind of cringing slightly. Like
as a designer,
it's one of those moments where I'm like, oh honey, no.
I know. I'm kind of like, but I will say the Luke one's kind of nice. I know he's got no face, but you can draw your own face on Luke.
You can draw your own face on Luke. That is very true. That's why I was like, you need to actually give him a face. And
if you are gonna color, you're an imagining. I think it's fun.
I'm like, I was like, is he hand? But no, it's just, it's really awkward. Like where the hand on like the left hand side is actually his right one.
Danya, if you are using a coloring book, you're a child and you're supposed to use your imagination.
Excuse you.
I use it and I'm using my imagination.
Yeah, I color in coloring books still. Like, you don't need to be a child.
Miss Fancy Pants over here probably can stay in the lines, unlike me. So, you know, I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, so if you are in the Cincinnati area or passing through, definitely check out the CincyMuseum.org website and check out their article on Star Wars and the Power of Costume. Admission is standard for the exhibition. It's going to be the same as the museum. So adults are $24, children 16, and seniors are going to be 21. All right. Last bit of news. I'm kind of excited for this, but I feel like it's a little too late. It's brand new news, but I feel like it's a little too... I don't know. You guys can decide. So PlayStation Plus, you've heard me, Eric, and many other people talk about PlayStation and Battlefront and how I'm excited for Battlefront 2. But if you are a PlayStation Plus member for the month of June, or if you sign up for the month of June, PlayStation just announced their free games for this month as a PlayStation Plus member. As a subscriber for this month, you will get Star Wars Battlefront Ultimate Edition for free. Yes, if you don't have Star Wars Battlefront, or you're just getting a PS4, and you decide you want to play online with friends like me and Eric, you can go ahead and get your PlayStation Plus subscription and get Star Wars Battlefront Ultimate Edition for free. The game's about a year old, it's a year and a half old, so I'm kind of like, it's cool. They're giving it for free. It's a good game. I like it.
Yeah, I mean,
new ones coming around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, if you haven't already purchased it, it's a nice gesture. Yeah.
I get it. The one thing I will say is nice is they're giving away the full edition, the ultimate edition. So you get all the expansion, like all the content that came out, like when Jakku came out, when Force Awakens came out, and you got the Rogue One content that came out when the movie came out. Like, so all the content is there and you get it for free. So that's nice. I paid over $100 for the game with all that content. So that's definitely, yeah.
That's intense, Mikey.
I know, right? It's, what happens when you pre-order instead of waiting?
Yeah, well, I don't happened. Like, I even I was gonna say, even for Star Wars, I'm not sure that I would be able to justify spending that much on the game.
Yeah, well, you know, I see it this way: if I get hours of entertainment out of it, it's like going to a movie multiple times, and you know, it's okay. But I have to justify it that way, otherwise I feel sad and cry. Anyway, let's move on to our spotlight topic. Someone who never makes me sad and cry is none other than Spectre 2, Hera Syndulla. So, real quick, Hera Syndulla is a Twi'lek from the planet Ryloth, where she grew up with her father, Cham Syndulla, who led a resistance to liberate their people. Early on Ryloth, Hera was able to acquire an old astromech, C110P, aka Chopper. And you know what? I never realized how Chopper came about until you actually wrote that out. C110P. The two ones in the dash make an H.
Yeah.
Like, I never did thought. You know?
Oh my gosh, that's adorable.
Shut up. I never put that together. You know, how like it makes sense for Chopper. But then you have to think also, like, now I'm going off on one of my rants. Now you also have to think about it. They don't speak English, per se, and they don't write letters like us. So how does it actually become Chopper? Mm-hmm. Yeah. See? Doesn't make sense. Anyway, in this early age with Chopper, who was a astromech from a fallen Y-Wing, Hera was inspired by the starships and desired to become a pilot. She was also inspired by her father's determination to fight for their people and their world. So, Danya, we only have a little bit of Hera when she was younger, from a couple different episodes in Rebels, a little bit from the book. We know that there is a conflict between her and her father. You know, what do you think about Hera at this young time when she's growing up being impressionable?
I mean, I feel like her convictions have always been fairly strong. Hera has always, throughout the entirety of Rebels, struck me as someone who, when she knows what she wants and when she believes in something, she's very single-minded in like making sure that it happens. And you see it a lot in the way that like we get those glimpses of her when she's younger as well, because everything that she was either inspired by or believed in or wanted to do, she made happen. So it's like, she might be inspired by her father's determination and everything like that, but her determination is something to be reckoned with, because, wow, she's incredible. I love her. Hera is one of my favorite characters, like, hands down.
Hera is very strong. I will say she is definitely a strong role model for a lot of people and just a great character. Coming from her early life, you know, it's obvious that her wanting to be a pilot was something that her and her father didn't see eye to eye with, and it kind of drove a wedge between them. But, you know, it drove her to become who she was. You know, she was that, you know, she learned from her father fighting against what was wrong, and that led her to become, you know, a member of the rebellion against the Empire, even all the way up to, we know she was there at the Battle of Scarif in Rogue One. So I definitely think early on she had the parentage, I guess, to kind of set her up for what she became. I guess nature versus nurture, if you will, a little bit there.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, but isn't that the case with, like, I mean, I feel it too. Like, the life that I'm living right now, like, it absolutely is not the life that, like, my mother envisioned for me. Like, my mother had, like, a very clearly defined idea of how I should or could live my life. And I feel like, to a certain extent, a lot of parents have, like, in their minds this idea of what they want their child to do, what they want their child to be. And especially for someone who comes from a family that is almost like, who is a leader in a leadership position, like, there is a certain amount of expectation to follow in those footsteps. So Hera's kind of ideal of becoming a pilot and fighting for what she believes in and all of that, like, that is very much that kind of forging your own path, deciding your future for yourself. That'll always cause friction between child and parent, especially when, for example, the idea of her becoming a pilot as well is something that will put her in the direct path of harm. So I feel like, to a certain extent, Chem, like, it's difficult for him because, though he knows that Hera is very capable, and we get a lot of that when we obviously go back and revisit, but basically the fact that she's putting herself in danger, that's always going to be something that's very difficult for him to reconcile with. But Hera is that kind of determined force that is like, no, this is what I believe in, this is what I'm doing. And, like, even for me, I was always very, like, when I was growing up, I was the same. I was always very headstrong in that, like, if I decided I was doing something, I was doing it. Like, and there was no one who could dissuade me or take me off that path. So, I feel very much like a kindred spirit with Hera quite a lot, in that I very much see a lot of myself in her. I don't know if it's, like, like, to an extent, I see that she's incredibly stubborn, but also that stubbornness comes from a place where it's like, I'm doing this because it's something I believe in and what I think is right, and therefore I am doing it. So, yeah. I don't know. I love Hera.
Who doesn't? Hera's great. So, obviously, that's before we get her, before she starts really fighting the Empire, all leading up to who she becomes. In season one, episode one of Rebels, I think Hera is probably the most defined character. Early on, you see her being obviously very headstrong, nurturing, and even more motherly too, to the crew of the Ghost. Even though she's not the official leader of the crew of the Ghost, she is Spectre too. She does do a lot of things specifically that I would say is, I don't know if you say Kanan and her have a parenting relationship. Maybe they have their own love relationship together at some point, those shippers that do, which is, I think it's obvious. But, you know, she does something really interesting with Ezra specifically. So as the crew of the Ghost go to free Wookiees from a Star Destroyer, you have Kanan, Zeb, Sabine go aboard. Hera, along with Ezra, stay with the ship, and they spot an incoming Star Destroyer. Hera tells Ezra to go and warn the others, but he didn't feel like he could, and since they make a run for it while they could. You know, he's afraid of the Empire. He's like, go now, we have to. But Hera obviously won't leave her friends behind. During this time, she has a talk with Ezra and convinces him to go and go warn them. He gets the courage to go and warn Kanan, Chopper, everybody to come back. And during that whole time, they end up escaping, even though it was a trap set up for them. And guess who gets caught? Ezra gets caught. So everyone else gets out, but Ezra gets caught. Again, with Zeb and Sabine saying, we can just leave him behind. He wasn't anything to us. Hera, being the mothering type who convinced Ezra to go back, convinces them to go back to free Ezra. Obviously, it all works out in the end where Ezra joins the crew of the Ghost. But it's during this kind of almost early moment on where you see Hera talking to Ezra, being very gentle with him and understanding that, hey, he is this orphan kid, I understand, but you're already fighting the Empire. What else, you know, don't just fight for yourself. You have more to fight for. That kind of, I think, defined her as someone who would give up herself for the good of others. Even though she's not the pseudo leader of that crew, she is such an integral part that it would not be the same without her.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you would agree.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing with it is the fact that that is what sets them apart from the Empire. Because the fact that she would go back for Ezra Like, that is a defining quality of what the rebellion stands for, and what they stand for, and what she believes in, because the Empire wouldn't go back for someone. They would be considered collateral damage, unless it's someone significantly high up in the ranks that has, like, I guess, information, or it would be dangerous for them to be in the hands of, like, someone else. So, like, the fact that they go back for him, or she convinces them to go back for him, or gets them to go back for him, like, that is, not only is it Hera through and through, but it's so integral to getting across what they all stand for, because it's that no one gets left behind mentality. This is a found family that is scraped together and desperately clinging to each other in a time where they only have each other, and it's just the lengths that they would all go to for each other, like, especially at the point in the series that we're at right now, is that they would do anything for each other. They, like, to a certain extent, I feel like Hera now has the responsibility of the wider rebellion coming up on her shoulders, because she's getting more and more involved in it. But if she was told to, like, leave any member of her crew behind, I don't think she would do it.
I'll agree with you. And this kind of leads us into, you know, some of the struggles she has with some of her crew as time goes on in Rebels. Like, by season two, she is now, or the Ghost's ship, is part of Phoenix Squadron, and she is the leader of Phoenix Squadron. So even though she's not the leader of the, you know, the Spectres of the Ghost crew, she is the leader of Phoenix Squadron. Kanan is very resistant to this, especially if you remember the beginning of season two, mainly because he's acting as part of a greater rebellion due to its similarities to the Clone Wars. You know, this is something that we talked about in the Kanan episode, that he was at the Clone Wars. You know, it was one of those things where after one of his first battles, Order 66 was, you know, turned on him and his master, and he had to run away for save his life. So having this kind of bickering between Kanan and Hera, I guess you would say almost mom and dad fighting, but yeah, not like, not angry fighting, but just kind of like her seeing it as, this is a, you know, obviously, I think the very first episode is called Spark of Rebellion, and that's what they are. The small band of rebels that they are is a spark. But by joining with other groups, starting Phoenix Squadron and becoming the leader of Phoenix Squadron, that spark has grown into a flame. And by the end of season three, which we'll talk about in a bit, you know, that flame has become into a full fire of all of the different rebel groups coming together on, you know, Dantooine when Mon Mothma calls for it. So these are the types of things that, you know, at first you could see, I can see and understand Kanan's hesitance or his resistance to this idea, just because, come on, he's from, you know, he grew up in a war torn time, but so did Hera, but they had different, very different outcomes and very different, different experiences in that. You know, she grew up on a planet with her father being a leader, instantly, if you would say, be a rebel, whereas he was something who was almost excited to be part of it, at least through the comics, and then have it all take away from him and be hunted. So it's a very different experience on it. What do you think about Hera joining Phoenix Squadron and kind of joining up with Sato and everyone else?
I mean, personally, I think it was an inevitable progression for her, because the one thing that Hera has always is a leader. Like, she's so good at being able to pull together and lead them and protect them, and she has that very level-headed kind of approach to everything that very much suits that idea of someone who can lead a group. So the fact that she becomes very quickly the leader of Phoenix Squadron is inevitable, for me, anyway. So, basically, for me, it was an inevitability. So it suits her perfectly, the fact that she becomes this leader, because it's just in her DNA. It's part of she is and who she continues to be. You know, she is very much responsible or feels responsible for the people on her ship. And just, yeah, it's just everything about it just exemplifies who Hera is. So for me, it was just, it was the perfect next step for the character because it made so much sense that when take.
Yeah. This also leads us to Rebel Zine to find a new base together, her as leader of Phoenix Squadron, because obviously there's more than just the crew of the Ghost. And then obviously Kanan is the leader of the Ghost crew. This leads Fulcrum, or Ahsoka as we know her, to go ahead and give them some suggestions to seek out an old ally of hers, none other than the clone troopers that are still around, and Rex. And during this time, again, you see the reluctance, and also on Kanan, you see the scars of the Clone Wars that are still there. Now, this is someone who, Hera trusts Fulcrum, trusts Ahsoka completely. And I think up until this point, Kanan would have said, I agree, and trust Fulcrum completely, even though I don't know if I believe in all the grouping up together. But at this point, he is forced to work with clone troopers, again, who kind of have been, were essentially the death of his master and the death of everyone else that he knew. So Hera has this, again, it's not the mom and dad fighting at this point, but more, I don't know if it's the mother instinct, but it's that empathy that she shows with Kanan in this. And I'm surprised that we see this in such a children's show, because the depth of Hera's character in the show is just mind-blowing when you really sit down to think about it. You know, she's able to talk to him and say, hey, remember this time you guys did fight together at some point. I trust them. Here are the other side of this, the other side of the story here. And she's able to essentially broker a reluctance agreement between both, Rex and Kanan. And it's mostly from Kanan's perspective where there's a problem, not Rex. Rex even falls into line and calls him general right off the bat, and just the loyalty that he has to Kanan right away because he is a Jedi and he fought alongside Anakin and Ahsoka. It's one of those things where she's able to, not shun him or push Kanan away, but being able to kind of bridge the gap between his pains and everything with it. Do you agree, or do you have any thoughts on what she was able to do there?
No, I agree. I think you pretty much said everything on that. I don't think there's anything that I can add to that. I think you've nailed.
Okay, there we go. That's good. So this leads us directly into kind of what we ended up seeing, the biggest evolution of Hera in season 3 with Thrawn. Previously, against every other Imperial adversary, Hera has always been one step ahead, whether it be using a new ship like the B-Wing that she was able to go ahead and prototype fly, to just being able to come up with some plans like all their scoop and, drop things, all the different tricks that they've done over the time no longer works when it comes to Thrawn. And it also takes her back to her home planet at the very beginning, where she goes back to Ryloth and to help her father because they, the rebels of Ryloth are suffering because they've been cut off by none other than Grand Admiral Thrawn. What do you think about Thrawn's relationship with Hera? Because he does know her fairly well. He knows what her Kallikori is and everything.
I mean, that's just thrown all over, though, isn't it? Because he states it outright, like, to know your enemy is to be able to beat them. Like, so he knows them through, like, their art, their culture, everything about them. Because if you know that about them, then you know their weaknesses, you know their sentimentality and how they feel about certain symbols and objects and what means something to them. So it's both an incredible insight into Hera through someone else's eyes, because he is taking her culture and things that define her and trying to twist it. So it was such a really interesting approach to learning more about what Hera cares about. And also, it was an incredible, like, jumping off point for Hera learning about herself and what has become important to her, more so than objects that can be replaced, because there are things in her life now that absolutely cannot be. And it was just such a beautiful moment, because when you have such a hugely important culture and identity and history to you that is in danger of, like, being taken away from you, like, especially when you are as strong a personality as Hera, can sometimes be, like, difficult to let that go or step away from it or try and see it objective. So the entire relationship between her and Thrawn was fascinating, both, like, in a way of getting him across as, like, a villain or an antagonist for them, but also for, like, who Hera is and how she felt and her whole culture. Like, it was just so well done in how they started getting that across. I think it was very, very clever to, in particular, intertwine those two characters, because Hera is, like, the de facto leader. So having him oppose her almost directly and challenge her directly, it was such a clever move on their part. I think it was also
clever because it allowed us to see Hera be vulnerable too.
Yes.
Which we hadn't really seen. We've seen her be mothering, we see her be empathetic, we've seen her do all these things as a leader, but never really be vulnerable. So just to put it in perspective, for those who aren't watching Rebels but are interested in this topic here of Hera Syndulla, at the beginning of season 3, Hera finds out that her ancestral home on Ryloth has been occupied. And she takes it up, and specifically the Kalakori, which is a Twi'lek kind of a treasure that's passed down from generation to generation, that was kind of like the only semblance from her mother, had not been recovered. She takes it upon herself to go and retrieve it. She even tells the other people, the ghosts, that this is something she's doing. You don't have to do it. But of course, they're all there for Hera, so they join in. So she sneaks in with Chopper, and instantly Thrawn is able to recognize her as she attempts to pass herself off as a peasant and a thief, because he, again, studies them and who he is, which we've talked about in the different Thrawn episodes. So in the very end, you know, she's worried about what price they had to give. You know, it's a two-part episode, but they ended up barely escaping. They didn't really give up anything, but they didn't gain anything other than possibly risking her father's life, risking her life and Chopper's life, and put everyone else in a bad situation. And at the same time, you almost see that they may not have gotten away if Thrawn didn't let them, which is kind of, again, Thrawn's own thought process there, where he's able to kind of see how they grow and move so he can predict them in the future. But at the end, as they're trying to escape, Thrawn just says, they've won this one, let them go. But it sees her vulnerable, because at the end she realized, like you mentioned, that there are things that are more important to her. She realized that even though she can't take the Kalakori, what her mother had given her, she has her family with her now. So she has a new family. Even though she's known that, you know, Sabine and Zeb and Chopper and Ezra and all them are her family, it was able to put it in new perspective and kind of open up that selfishness that she had for her own family was not something that was the only thing that's important. Her current family, you know, her family that she's with on the ship is her most important part to remember now. So I'm happy the way they set that up. It also set it up to seeing at the end when they're trying to flee from their chopper base, and her and Ezra saying, like, we need to call upon our allies. And she's able to sacrifice, not herself, but see the sacrifice of someone like Sato to get everyone else to be able to escape was something that, you know, you have to have her understand that she is now family with all these people, her extended, you know, Phoenix Squadron family. So I personally am happy that that's the way they handled. Anything else, Danya, about Hera? I know this is a fairly short episode, only 50 minutes, but I think we cover most of it. Is there anything that I'm missing?
No, I mean, the other thing that I just love, and we did talk about it a little bit last week, is just, like, the dynamic of the relationship between her and Kanan. There's something so really refreshing about it, I guess, as a relationship, that I feel like it's such an even relationship. They both bring this vulnerability to each other. They both have this softness that they each bring out in each other, and it just, for me, it's one of my favorite relationships in the Star Wars universe. Like, the two of them, they balance each other out, like, beautifully, and it's something that I continue to enjoy. And also, I delight in everything to do with, like, their interaction, and, like, how they, even how Kanan reacts to meeting her family for the first time. Like, there's just something...
That's true.
Yeah, there's just something so nice about it. So, it's such a positive relationship, which isn't to say that it's without, like, its issues, because no relationship is perfect. Like, they go through their ups and downs, but at the same time, it's still, like, it is almost the core relationship of that crew, because it's the constant, and they are almost in their own way, when, especially when Ezra comes in, like, they are this new family unit for him. Like, it's such a nice relationship, because as well, it just, there's so much give and take, and there's also just something so strong about it. And yeah, I just love, I love, 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 love that relationship so much.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Now, it's really funny that you mentioned Kanan's reaction to Hera's, meeting Hera's father. You have to remember, Kanan has a similar type of reaction when Lando starts to flirt with Hera. And I remember this vividly because, you know, it's Lando Calrissian. But yeah, you know, and the fun part is that Hera even plays along with it. So it's kind of... She's not all mother, you know, she is fun still, but she obviously has her own set moral compass, if you will, that she follows, and I don't think I've ever seen her deviate from that, or even the crew of the Ghost, because she is that kind of voice of the, you know, conscience, you know, if you will. Is she the conscience for the Ghost crew? And I think she is, when we see that in the very first episode, when she says, we have to go back for Ezra. Okay, anything else, Danya, about...
No, I think I'm good.
Hera Syndulla? All right.
No, I'm
hopefully
good.
We'll learn more about... Okay, hopefully we'll learn more about Hera Syndulla as time goes on with season 4 of Rebels. And I would love to know more about her inside Rogue One and what happens post that. But thank you all for listening to another episode of Resistance Radio. Feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at @RRadioPodcast or on Facebook at facebook.com/resistanceradiopodcast. Remember to visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. And as always, I'm Mikey B.
And I'm Danya.
And may the Force be with you.
And also with you.